This is Microphone Check, hip-hop from NPR Music. I'm Franny Kelly. All year, Morning Edition and NPR Music have been running radio pieces about rap albums released 20 years ago, in 1993. And for a special episode of Microphone Check, we invited a group of people who were working in hip-hop back then to meet us at the Ace Hotel in New York City and tell stories about that productive and creative year. Faith Newman, A&R at Def Jam and then Columbia, who signed Nas. Ralph McDaniels, the host of Video Music Box on Public Access TV. Prince Paul, producer for De La Soul and the Gravediggers. Mike Dean, engineer and producer at Rap-A-Lot Records. And Stretch Armstrong, DJ for WKCR's Stretch and Bobbito radio show, all spoke with me and my co-host Ali Shaheed Muhammad in front of a live audience. This is an edited version of that evening. So, let's go around and say what you guys were doing in 1993.
I was in Houston, Texas, working with like Bushwick Bill, the Ghetto Boys, Scarface.
You told me stories about being in like guitar centers. What's the Zero story?
Yeah, it's a story. One time when Zero got out of prison, like for the third time, I think. He got out of jail, came to my house. I took him to the Guitar Center to buy some gear to start recording. And the salesman was like, you know, Zero, I wasn't really into your last album. It's like, and he knocked him the fuck out. It was like, it was incredible.
It's like the rudest Guitar Center salesman of all time.
Yeah, I guess he made a bad decision, you know. He should have listened to Zero's lyrics and he would have known not to fuck with him. So, stuff's changed a lot since then.
And, like, what gear were you using back then?
ASR-10, just old, like, Korg M1s, the Junos 106s. Like, 1993, I think the first MPC 2000s came out. We had, like, four of them in Houston.
Man.
Yeah, a friend of mine worked at Akai and got us hooked up before they came out.
Wow. And
that was our first time we ever saw a drum machine was then.
N.O. Joe?
Yeah, N.O. Joe brought the first MPC 60 before that. We were like, what the fuck is this? Because we were just working with samples and samplers.
Can you explain, like, what the difference is between those three machines?
A sampler, you can just sample something and chop it up and manipulate it with keys.
Yeah.
Drum machine, you can do the same thing, but you put it on pads. It has like note repeat buttons and
has
16 levels.
Sequencer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A drum machine has an MPC has a sequencer, so you're not only sampling, but you're also arranging where the sounds fall in time.
You know, like a pattern sequencer, and you can put patterns into songs. You know.
So you have more agility, basically.
Yeah.
How does that change the songs that you make?
I mean, before samplers, there were drum machines, and before drum machines, there were live bands emulating disco hits, which and MCs would rap. I mean, like Rapper's Delight, everyone knows that record. They're rapping over an emulation, a live band emulating Good Times, which was a hot record at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of sampling, well, they couldn't sample because the technology hadn't arrived yet.
Right.
They actually have a band go in and play the music. A sampler allowed you to actually take a digital snapshot of a record, and the sequencer in a drum machine, or rather a drum sampling instrument like an MPC allowed you to not just sample, but also loop and place drum hits wherever you want them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just was a, you know, the completion of the evolution of making music via sampling.
Understood. But then you guys with Balloon Mind State, you kind of took it back in the other direction. Is that right? And you're experimenting with members of the JBs?
I mean, you know, we did some live recording. We recorded Fred Wesley and Maceo Parker for that album. And yeah, because, we, you know, the whole key back then was, yo, we want to sound old and dusted. Whatever mics they use, whatever, you know, studio, you know, and that was the thing back then, was to try to make everything sound like those records that we sample. And, you know, having those guys at our disposal made it easy. Especially when we're known for, especially during that time, was, okay, Prince Paul samples everything. He gets sued. He does all this other stuff, you know. So, you know, I had to switch it a little bit.
Yeah, we tried not to sample much. We tried to just use, like, break beats and play whatever we could over it. Like you said, make it sound old and shitty.
Yeah, see, he was smart with it, man, you know, because I was sampling everything and anything. And that's why when you look at my publishing and go, wow, I got 2% of this song, 0.5% of this song. Sold a million copies, but I made $10, you know?
Rich in props.
Hey, that's what it is, man.
Yeah, I've had that before.
So how did you find out about new music at this time then? Like, how were files being shared?
Oh, you asking me? Oh, you mean cassettes?
Records. It was a file, right? Record junkies. Records. In 93, I spent probably, you know, at least 4 hours a day in the record store. I mean, I should have gotten paid to be in the record store because, I'd help customers. I'd be behind the turntables. No, I'm serious, for real.
What stores?
Downtown, downstairs, Rock and Soul, Vinyl Mania.
Music Factory.
I mean, it's a different world right now. I mean,
yeah, none of those places are open anymore, right?
It doesn't even look like the same city.
Well, the record stores is where, you know, you got a chance to see what somebody else was into, too. You know, it wasn't just about going to buy records. It was about the community of, absolutely, you know, of a record store. Mm-hmm. You know, like if Stretch came in and I had heard of Stretch and maybe I never met Stretch, I'm looking to see what Stretch has in his hand and what he's buying so I can go listen to it, you know. So, you know, the record store is missed for a number of reasons. You know, we don't know what you're downloading now. We just hear it when you play it, you know? So I miss
that. It was like a chat room.
Right.
Like I remember going to buy, enter the stage, and then a bunch of people would crowd around, and then you would talk about each song on there, and everybody would walk away with their vinyl. You know? That's how it was.
Yeah, sense of community in the record store was huge. I mean, in addition to people just buying records, you never knew who was going to come in with their promo, with the white label, put it on, maybe have five to sell.
And the other thing, too, is that we all went to the same clubs, same parties on the same nights, you know, and everybody knew about every new record that was coming out. It was a very kind of insular community. That was our social network.
I was just the opposite. Wherever I seen everybody else at, I wasn't there.
You were there, Paul. I saw you, Frankie's Soul Kitchen, a couple times, maybe.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I guess I was seen.
You were there.
That was leisure.
Oh, yeah.
And at that time, the studio budgets were pretty big, right? I mean, Prodigy told Ali and I a story one time about, you know, sometimes people would come through and the legend was like you could get dinner if you knew somebody who was working.
Dinner and diapers.
Mobb Deep's people would come through and buy milk and diapers on the loud budget. Yeah. Faith, you have any experience with that?
No. Oh, I watched every penny. Well, yeah, I mean, the studio budgets were generous, and there was also nobody really monitoring. So if you were at Unique or D&D or one of those places, you know, there could be 20 people in there who are not making a record, and, you know, just put it on the tab. Order food, order whatever. There wasn't a lot of monitoring the way there is now.
But also, definitely, keep in mind that these labels would, which had traditionally been recording albums that required lots of musicians, bands, these budgets, even though they were generous, by today's standards, they were minuscule compared to recording a rock album, mm-hmm, which required a producer, you know, miking drums, doing, you know, multiple takes of every pass, you know, yeah, vocals, background vocals, and
you
know,
depending,
you know, if you were an alternative band, then you might be doing one take, two takes, and, you know, it sounds like shit, but that's what we want. But if you're a metal band or making a record for, you know, Light FM or whatever, you know, they had this really high production value, and those budgets were huge compared to hip-hop budgets. So while artists may have, you know, felt like they were, you know, really getting this great ride with their studio budgets, at the end of the day, for the labels, they really, you know, it was a deal for the labels. Well, you know, the records, you know, a lot of these groups were self-produced. Mm-hmm. You know, basically, the work is done at home. I know A&R people, though, will always get vexed at artists writing their lyrics in the studio. Please, come to the studio prepared. And you need to see an MC at the desk.
Yeah.
You know, with 128 input SSL console, and he's writing rhymes. Like, you couldn't do that at home?
Oh, no, I was just the opposite, man. Once I realized where that budget went, I made a home studio, pre-produced, came with everything done, and tried to pocket as much of the upfront money, because once you made... But check this out. Once you made enough records as I had at that point, because it was 8 years into it, and realized that I might not get a royalty check. What I see up front may be what I have to live off for the next few years. You start to say, you know, how can I kind of cut those costs?
And part of it is make your own studio, pre-produce as much as you can, and pocket as much as you can, because the label will find 1,000 ways not to pay you.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The budgets may have been generous, but it was all getting charged against the artist anyway.
True.
Yeah,
they'd recoup.
There's no freebies, you know?
Yeah, they'd recoup it double probably once they charge you a service fee.
Yep.
You know, accounting fees and whatever bullshit they add to it.
Interesting, though, I think for some artists that came from neighborhoods and backgrounds that weren't ideal, to put it lightly, the studio was an oasis for them. I mean, like, home would be hectic. I mean, if you're, you know, in the projects, and especially bubbling up as an artist that's recognized, you might become even more of a target than you would just as being a regular kid in the hood. You know, going to the studio was like a vacation. You had a place where you were safe, you could bring all your boys, and you could be creative. So
that's when the studio, man. When I was at Calliope, they had hookers, drug dealers. I wasn't safe. I was safe at home.
Yeah, well, not everyone had the same experience.
Yeah, the studio wasn't that safe in Houston either. Lots of guns, lots of drugs, lots of craziness. Yeah.
That was when there were studios.
And part of the budget, too, was videos, right?
Yep.
Huge video budgets, yeah.
Bananas big. I mean, $1 million. Then they weren't.
What was the budget for the Cream video?
Cream, $30,000. And that wasn't a lot of money.
That was teeny back then.
Yeah, that was light, you know. But, you know, Riz is a smart guy, so, you know, he would just tell you this is the budget, you know. You don't know how much he actually got.
But like $100,000, like that.
But Black Moon, who got the props? I did that. And, you know, I told him that, you know, meet me on 14th Street. And I think they had, like, $10,000. And I said, all right, I got 2 rolls of film, and we'll shoot it in 1 take. And we did it, like, in 3 hours, who got the props. And that was it. You know, Cream, you know, was a little bit more now. You know, Loud had, you know, that RCA backing, and they had a little bit different situation. Nas, It Ain't Hard to Tell, was really, you just feeling it out at that point. And so I did the EPK for Nas.
Yes,
which was, Nas was like, I want it to just look like Video Music Box, Ralph. Can you do that? I said, all right, no problem. So we did that, and then somebody said, well, we need to do a video. And that video budget was only $15,000 for It Ain't Hard to Tell.
Yeah, and it was very cold that day.
Yeah, it was very cold. And so, you know, it mattered on, you know, what the situation was. You know, I was doing, prior to that, we were doing, like, you know, Big Daddy Kane and Biz and, you know, a bunch of R&B stuff where the budgets were a little bit higher, but it was a transition at that time. So, you know, yeah, the video budget was kind of like we're feeling it out. You know, I mean, I think MTV, Yo MTV Raps was kind of in effect at that point, so it was getting airplay. So we knew that was going to happen, and we definitely were going to play it on, you know, on my show on Video Music Box, and there were other outlets that were popping up. But, yeah, you know, the one thing that was cool about that was that at that time was that I could just sit with RZA and we could talk about doing the video, and that was it. I never even spoke to anybody at the label or anything like that. I could sit with, you know, Drew Ha and Buckshot and talk about their thing. You know, Nas, Sony was a little bit different, a little bit more of corporate, you know.
No, it wasn't.
You know, but it wasn't. I don't think me and Faith ever talked about the video. It was like, all right, here's the video, and we handed it in, and they were like, all right, it looks good to us, and that was it. It was out next week, so. Once they started putting people's names on MTV, the directors' names, that's when it got complicated because everybody wanted their name on MTV. Mm-hmm. Even the artists now, I directed it. I'm like, you didn't do nothing, man. Were you crazy? So it was so simple then.
Yes. You told me a story about the Ain't Hard to Tell video, about the, tell me about the fashion. Why? It was really cold, right? But that was okay because everybody wanted to wear like a big bubble goose, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, no doubt. That was fashion. You know, that was what was going on, you know. And we didn't shoot that video in Queensbridge at all. And I don't know why, you know, from minute to minute, I know Faith is probably knows and you know.
Well, we wanted to be at the band shell for the Wild Style.
Right, for the Wild Style. And we ended up shooting that part there, and then we did the rest in Coney Island. And I liked Coney Island because nobody was out there. It had snowed. So it looked like, you know, it was just clean snow. And I said, this is great. This is a new artist, clean slate. Let's put him in the middle of the snow and have his guys hanging, kind of hanging around in the background. And it was most of the women worked at Sony at that time, if I'm not mistaken, that were part of that project. And
Ashley Fox, Taisha Harris.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they all talked about how good Nas looked. So I was like, all right, so we got to make this guy look really good in this video because women seem to love Nas. I know Nas from, you know, the street, the corner, you know, a bunch of little dudes from Queensbridge, you know, it's just causing havoc all the time. He wasn't pretty to me. But I could tell that once I got in a circle of women, it was like, we love him. So we, you know, wanted to have nice, pretty shots that made him, his features pop out and, you know, and look fashionable.
He had trouble looking at the camera, though, remember?
Yeah, real nervous. Yeah, real nervous with the camera. Wasn't totally comfortable with that at all. Eye contact, you know. I don't think that thugs make eye contact with you unless they're going to kill you. You know? They have a problem with that, you know, so.
I mean, to be fair, most 19-year-olds don't make eye contact, right?
You're right. Yeah, I guess so.
Faith, there's some really legendary pictures of you from this year. The fashion was casual for women as well as men.
Yeah, it was casual. It was like, I have to say, people were like dressed like you're like going to war or something. It was, everything was, you know, Carhartt coats and, you know, everybody, like all the girls, we would buy our, you know, our pants from like Dave's Army Navy, and everybody wore Tim's no matter what. Like, dressing up would be like you'd wear, like, for a girl, like, you'd wear, like, a nice top that was kind of tight or short or whatever, but the jeans would be crazy baggy, and you always had your boots on and your beeper in your pocket, you know. It was definitely, you know, and that was kind of how it was across the board. Like, you were, like, you were ready to, like, troop at any minute, you know. That's kind of how it felt.
The best part of the Puff Daddy era was that women started dressing like women.
I don't know if you can say that best.
What's that?
No, boo.
I'm saying.
I think it was kind of like the great equalizer. I think it actually was kind of cool that everybody was in this community and we all kind of had a uniform. Women didn't have shit hanging out. I mean, it was, you know, you could be cute without, you know, being, you know, looking crazy.
Well, you bring up a couple of things. I mean, there were a lot more women in hip-hop in the business and behind the scenes than people acknowledge. What was that? You know, you told me a story about how, like, if you were working in R&B, you wouldn't have moved up as quickly.
Well, you know, when I started, I had an internship at Columbia Records in 86, and it was kind of like, you know, the boys' club, very male-dominated, very, you know, you're talking about the era, because you're coming out of the late 70s, you're coming out of the whole disco era, and it felt old, and, you know, and then at that time, you had, at the labels, the only women you would ever see working a major label were in publicity. That was it. You never saw anybody in promotion or marketing, definitely not A&R. I can't remember a single A&R woman that I knew from back then. What hip-hop did was, I got hired to work at Def Jam in 87, and it was kind of an equalizer because it was like, I don't care, you know, your race, your gender, whatever, are you into hip hop, are you good at what you do, you know, you're hired. And it was just a different, it was being a part of the community as opposed to kind of, obviously there's always gonna be sexism to some degree, but it was a new way of looking at it, at the business. And I truly believe that if I had been kind of stuck in that world at Columbia, when I started interning, that there's no way I would have gone on to do A&R, you know, or sign acts or anything like that. So they used to have, I mean, it was like pop, and then they called it the black music department. And, you know, radio was very strict, the playlists were very strict. I know you guys remember how they fought against playing any rap. It was like a major battle. And, you know, and so it created this kind of camaraderie, like a us against them kind of thing. You know, the old school versus the new school.
That's why you had to wear those fatigues.
That's where, exactly.
Going to war.
I was going
but
to battle.
I'm saying by 95, 96, the war was over. You won.
Remember how R&B albums used to have the no rap version, right?
What'd you say?
If an R&B song featured a rapper,
Yeah.
You always have to do the no rap.
The no rap version so the radio would play it.
Just so they play it.
So I do credit hip hop then for that. I don't think that the same thing applies now. I can't say that that's true. I think it's gotten worse instead of better for women in the music industry. And that's also a function of the industry just has shrunk to just a fraction of what it used to be. The first people to get pushed out are usually the women, unfortunately. But we'll live in it.
And the black music guy, the black radio guy, like we don't see the black radio guy anymore. We don't see him. Now it's just some dude, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to mention any names. Yeah. But the black dude is out, you know.
No, it's the same. It's the same. It's the same thing. The industry became very, very narrow.
Mike, were there a lot of women at Rap-A-Lot?
Yeah, most of the staff was women, actually.
The behind the scenes. Yeah, always
like, probably say 60% of the staff at Rap-A-Lot were women, like all the way up to the CEO.
You guys also put out Choices song, The Big Payback, one of my favorites of all time.
Oh, my God. How do you know about Choice? You were like 10 years old. You shouldn't have been listening to that, right?
Well, you guys did have an anniversary and put out a box set.
Yeah.
I can find that, right?
Okay. Yeah, that was the nastiest rap music ever. I think. That or Pimp C. I'm not sure who wins.
Let's talk about performing like nasty rap, right? People made these songs and then they had to go take them on the road. How is that working? I mean, were you part of live bands at that time?
It's awkward, I'd say. To say the least, a bunch of guys up on stage, you know, doing nasty songs together. But I'll let somebody else song that, because I never went on the road with these guys back then.
I heard nasty songs. That doesn't apply to me.
The ones that we've heard.
I was in a performance hiatus at the time because I was more to producing at that point. And I wasn't any given group. You know, it was at the end of Stetsasonic, which I was my first group. I did a little traveling with De La in the early days, and then it wasn't until the next year until I started traveling with the Gravediggers and Wu-Tang is when it got real.
I want to talk about that. Like 15 mics on the stage.
It was real. Now it was funny because I had a long like set of pause between like doing shows again and going from like, you know, Stetsasonic with hip hop band and, you know, De La and everybody's happy across stage to like, yo, when we go inside this place, just make sure, cause I think dudes got guns outside and yo, the cops might come, hide the gun, and then da da da, and we gotta leave the hotel. And, you know, I was like, whoa. You know, there was a useful army fatigue back then. You know? Should have been like concrete color or something. running through the city, man, trying to avoid people. It was hectic.
Yeah. Do you remember going to any other shows like where it wasn't exactly that style?
I remember just going to shows and, yeah, I remember there being a few shootouts back in those days. The good old days.
Yeah.
That's when New York was like, people were like, yo, I'm not going to New York. Man, you crazy? I'm going to get mugged. You know, it was in those days. You know, and I remember you had to pick and choose where you went and who was performing and, you know, certain things. Mm. But, you know, I stayed close to the exit.
I have a story. Actually, two. Tribe Called Quest had a show with Too Short. I don't recall which city, Midwest city it was. But, you know, we went up there doing our thing. I think this was like around Midnight Marauder. Between Low End Theory, Midnight Marauder time, we felt like we had something strong to contribute. And De La Soul taught us a lot about giving a stage show and how to really give it to guys. And we thought we were at the top of our thing. And then Too Short came out with some synthesizers, no turntables, just straight band, and murdered it. And he had absolutely no sentiments, I think, about saying the word that we all know he's famous for saying and everything else that came after it, and neither did the crowd. I think they lived for it. It was like the Tribe Called Quest thing was clean and it was cool, but they wanted it muddy, dirty, give it to me, real fucked up. Like, we just stood on the side and was like, wow, that really works. Cool.
And so what is the crowd doing at these shows, like, to go crazy? Like, people know all the words? Are people dancing? People, like, jumping up and down?
It's no different than watching 2 Chainz perform right now. I'm dead serious.
Not everybody here knows what that means.
Stop lying. Y'all don't know, y'all have never seen a 2 Chainz performance?
I have.
At least on television. Yo, the crowd, the audience, the people really get into him. And it is equally shocking to me watching that now as it was watching Too Short. Because I'm like, I just don't get it. But there's a connection. So yeah, the people sing it. And it's like, I think we just tell this story. It was with Solange. There's a record that I hate playing. I love to hate the play. Hate the play. It's Dr. Dre's Explosive. The song sounds great. It's a great song, but lyrically, it's just like, I feel like my mom, my grandma, and my great-grandmother is like, you know, mom is here, grandma there, great-grandma standing on my head when I'm playing that song. But it's the one song that we all know the lyrics to. And we are proud singing it, and we sing it loud, and we dancing, and it's just like, that's hip-hop, you know?
I just wanted to bring a shared experience that Ralph and I had at a club in 1993 when we were shooting Nas's EPK, the live performance.
Yeah, that was that was interesting. If you ever see the EPK, or even in It Ain't Hard to Tell video, there's a scene where, like, there's feathers flying in the air. Like, people were getting robbed in the crowd, you know, yeah, like with blades and like their, yeah, goose from their goose down, you see it like kind of like flying, yeah, in the air.
I had promised the promoter
Maria
of the
Davis.
Club. No, it was Jessica.
Oh, Jessica? Oh,
yeah.
Wow. Okay.
She said, I can't, because there had already been a couple incidents, and it seemed like everywhere Nas went, there was gunplay
somewhere.
Those
little guys.
Yeah, the little guys. And everything was going fine. I said, it's Ralph, and it's going to be fine, and don't worry. We're going to shoot it. We're going to be in, out. And everything was fine up until the very end. And then somebody shouted Queensbridge, and then you hear pop, pop, pop.
Like, right, he was standing, like, right next to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm under a table. You know, I'm like, even then, I'm like, I'm too old for this shit. Like, I mean, the cash registers got robbed.
Oh, I didn't even know the cash registers got robbed, too. Wow.
That's what I said, when New York is New York.
I was New York, yeah.
It's not like that no more.
I called Nas that whole night, cursing him out, because I knew it was somebody in his crew, mm-hmm, that was on the stage.
It's never him. It was, you know, just, and you knew who it was, too.
It was too close. My ear was ringing still. It was the guy. It had to be somebody that we knew.
But you remember, I mean, you guys remember a time in the clubs where it was knives and chain snatching. That was like Latin Quarter dance.
Oh, the Latin Quarters, man. How much fun was that?
It was the best.
I remember
you
one dude.
He did go out.
One dude had a sword.
He did.
Latin Quarters like this. Swinging it around. I was like, oh, how did he get that? Those are the last days of Latin Quarters.
Yes.
That's when cats
was
get there.
There was the last day. Remember,
yeah,
there was,
yeah,
the mirror,
man.
There was blood all down the mirror.
Oh, it was
like,
incredible.
It's over. Party's over.
And I was there, chilling. Man, dudes would get their fronts snatched out. I mean, like, hit out their mouths with, like, hammers back,
yep,
then. The good old days in New York City, ladies and gentlemen.
But think about all the artists who had their first shows there.
Yeah, man.
Public,
right? Even, I remember us talking to Ice-T. He's like, yo, I went to Latin Quarter. I had to tuck in my chain.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, and that's quote unquote Ice-T. I was like, really? He's like, man, I'm not stupid, man. It's crazy.
I mean, 93 is not the only, like, really, really special year for hip hop. I get a lot of heat about proclaiming 93. A lot of people say it should be 88, for example, or 94 or 96. Ali and I interviewed Marley Marl recently. Did I do it right? Yeah. And he told us that 88, which is when he put out In Control Volume 2, I'm sorry, 1, on which appeared The Symphony, which is another video that Mr. McDaniels directed, with another good story behind it. It was do or die, right? Like, you had to make it. You had to make really, really good music. It sounds like that was the case in 93 as well. Is that true?
Yes. And it was a different kind of good.
What do you mean?
Well, in 88, you know, we talked about this the other day. You know, as good a lyricist as Kane was, for instance, he still had Scoob and Scrap. He still had dancers, and people were still dancing, and it was, you know, and then stuff just got really serious and thoughtful, and that's how, and the rhymes got, I think, even more intricate and more thoughtful and darker, because those were the times. You know, we were entering a recession. And
crack.
And crack had kind of, in the beginning, it was like something to like kind of talk about, you know, crack is whack, and you had New Jack City and all this stuff. Then it was like reality set in, like, oh shit, this is really, really bad. And people were seeing a lot of bad things happen to a lot of people. And it just changed the dynamic. And I think, you know, I always said, like, why Illmatic is so special, and there are many reasons, but it's almost like Nas, like, sitting in his window, looking out on the world and telling stories. And nobody was dancing anymore.
Why
except
laughing?
Paul. Paul was dancing. That was, you know.
And I his, never danced.
I know.
I might have did the Humpty dance.
Yeah.
That's probably about it. But, yeah, it was funny. It was funny you mentioned dancing because I remember at some point, like, yo, you dancing? You ain't dancing, son, are you? It's just, it was not cool to dance at all. Yeah.
Were you spending some time in L.A. at this point, or none?
None
so far?
Not until, like, 1996, I'd
okay.
say.
Okay. Was anybody spending time in L.A. at this point?
Not if I could help it.
We had an office in L.A. We were doing video, mostly R&B stuff at that time. But in New York, I was always New York. My partner, Lionel, the vid kid, he was the vid kid on the show. He liked to go to L.A., and, you know, I was like, I hate L.A., man. I got to come back to New York. I mean, I like the music, I like the artists, but I didn't like the people, you know, just some of the people were just kind of like, it was fake. It was Hollywood, you know. It was, people want to be, in L.A., people want to be in Hollywood. That's what they want to do. They want to make movies. Like, we really, for me, I really cared about and I really liked the music. Some people were in it just because there was money there. Like, maybe whatever, they were in the rock and roll prior to this, and it was kind of like not happening anymore. And so they were making that move over to hip hop because they knew there was money there. So I just couldn't wait to get back to New York. But, you know, when you talk about 93, I just remember when I first time I heard Wu, Protect Your Neck, you know, and I wanted to be involved in that because it sounded like what was going on the street corner at that particular time. It was Fatigues. It was Tim's, you know. It was, you know, just raw. It wasn't fly. It was nothing fly about it. It wasn't, you know, leather medallions. It was nothing about it. It was big gold chains, and it was, but you weren't fly. You were just, you know, you still were drinking 40s. You know, it didn't get to champagne yet. And when I first heard, you know, Protect, and I worked with the Genius, the GZA, and I worked with Prince Raheem. So when they came with that, it was two totally different things. I was like, what is this? What made you go in this direction? You know. But I think it was what was going on around them, you know, and it was the times. And even with the Genius, Raekwon's gonna kill me for this one. Raekwon and O Dirty were dancing in one of the Genius's videos. And we did the Genius. But dancing was out now. It was 93. And it had changed. And so, you know, and I didn't even know that O Dirty and Raekwon, you know, were artists like that. I thought they just hung around the Genius.
That happened to you too, Stretch, huh? When they brought the white label Protect Your Neck up to the studio, and you didn't know who, you knew, you recognized the RZA from when he was called Prince Raheem. Yeah. Raheem, I'm sorry.
Ooh, we love you, Raheem. That was the name.
And you think Ghostface was in that party that came up to the studio and broke the door down?
I think that's the night I actually wasn't there. I was out of town.
That's right.
They came by with the white label, and they kind of forced their way into the station, and it was a little bit of a melee. And then the next week, I had the white label and started playing it.
And so how did you know? Like, now if somebody puts something out, like, you know immediately if it's getting good response or if it's starting to build or whatever. Like, how did you know that people were excited about Protect Your Neck?
The clubs?
Well, I never really cared about what the listeners thought in terms of what I played.
Okay.
And I think that's why the show developed such a loyal following is because I guess my ears, my sensibility sort of worked with the people that listen. It just, I can't explain it. They're also, you know, this was pre-internet, so you didn't have the immediate feedback.
Right.
And, you know, the phones would ring, but how many phone calls can you answer in an hour? You know, maybe a handful. So, you know, you could tell if someone, if people were feeling a record, because you'd play something and the phones would light up and, you know, yo, who's that? Yo, what is that? What is that? Or, yo, who the, turn that motherfucker off immediately. I remember when Be Real came up, when Cypress first came up, and I played Pigs, and then Be Real rapped, and people were not feeling Be Real in New York that night. That was the first time New York heard Cypress Hill, and it wasn't nice. But you know, it's interesting because when you know anyone who's worked in you know behind the scenes or in radio, the impression that an artist will give you in person can play a big role in how much you want to support them. Mm-hmm. When Fat Joe came out, I was like, he's kind of not really hot. Like, he's gonna kill me now. But then I met Joe.
He's much skinnier now.
I met Joe and I was like, I love this guy. I'm playing all his records forever. Because he was such a hip hop fan. I mean, as a graffiti artist in the 80s and as a, not a dancer, but as a, and then as an MC, I mean, he, you know, Fat Joe came to be, you know, pretty dope as a lyricist eventually. Trying to get out of that one. Come on. Come on, Firewater. Huh? He held his own. Stop it. You guys are terrible. People gotta make money. What? Come on.
The clubs would break those records.
Absolutely, sure, yeah.
I think with Wu-Tang, like, if every time they play Protect Your Neck, not every time, but most of the time, a fight would break out, and I'd be like, okay, that's a hot record. Like, it got people going, you know? It's hot.
Yeah, it was like that was the 93 equivalent of the bridge, right, of South Bronx.
It was your inspiration for making a song.
On. Mm-hmm.
You want to make some shit that people are going to just beat the shit out of each other in the clubs. So yeah. Then you've succeeded.
So did you guys know in 93 that what was happening was special?
Yes.
Undeniably.
You knew.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
You felt it.
Yeah, I mean, when records like the infamous Ready to Die, 93 to Infinity, 36 Chambers, I mean, those records were, to me, you know, when people refer to the Golden Age, you know, being a 90s thing, I say, no, the Golden Age was really, to me, 86 to 88, you know, with Boogie Down Productions, Big Daddy Kane, Ultra Magnetic, Tribe Called Quest, De La Soul. I mean, that's, to me, that's, it doesn't get better than that, Kane, Juice Crew. But in 93, with these records, you felt like, oh, okay, this is,
just felt like more grown up in a way.
Yeah, well,
like it had aged nicely.
Absolutely, but yeah. I mean, if you look at hip hop in the '90s, it was really, I mean, when I got on the radio in '90, you know, we kind of like,
no, there was that those garbage years.
We snuck
like
in
90,
because
92.
there wasn't a lot going on. The tradition of the incredible mix shows, the New York City mix shows of the '80s, by '90 had largely disappeared and really just sort of lost their footing, and that's where Bobbito and I kind of snuck in and were able to you know do something that we feel had been done but wasn't being done anymore, and then by 93 it was like a whole new renaissance.
But you told me that you didn't know, Paul.
Oh no, not at all. I mean, you know, I'm like, music's cool. It's not no 88 though.
Thank you.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So, you know, what I compared it to then was that era. And even when you listen to like the Wu-Tang record, remember 88, 87, oh, it was crazy. Because it was just a feeling, a vibe at that time. Now, we could all look in hindsight and like, I knew it was dope. You know what I'm saying? Because it is what it is. I don't know, maybe this year, y'all, you know, 20 years from now, you go, man, Versace, and everything else. We knew that was the era, you know. If you told me that in 93, I couldn't say that. You know, I was like, yeah, it's cool. But, you know, and that's just being honest, you know, because if I knew a lot of things in 93, I would invest in gold. There's a lot of things I would you know, Apple. You know what I'm saying? I'd have been a millionaire, but it is what it is.
So, do you guys have any questions?
Large professor in the house. What up, brother?
Whoa!
Could you... I hate to put you on the spot real quick, but just you are definitely, you know, like you the godfather of this as well. So could you step up and just tell us like what hip hop was going on, what it was for you in 93, what the feeling was you were part of making, bringing Nas to the world?
93 was colorful, experimental. I always refer to that era as the burner age of hip hop, like saying that in the graffiti sense. Like graffiti, you had throw ups, you had regular writing, scribbles. But when we came out, a lot of the color, like the loops were colorful. It was, it wasn't just boom, bat. It was like a groove. It was, so it was just an explosion of color and experimentation, and it was different versions of it. It was, you know, you had the hard, you had the cool loops, you know, it was just an explosion. Like, it was just like hip hop, like, kind of, sort of at its peak. You know, I'll say traditional hip hop, kind of, sort of at its peak at that time, definitely.
Riggs Morales, big fan. This is a question for both Ali Shaheed and for Mike Dean. Dr. Dre once acknowledged that he was really soaking in Tribe's work when he was working on some of them Death Row masterpieces. I'm curious to know if who some of you guys were influenced by or at least inspired by in working on your individual works. Ali Shaheed on the East Coast front, and Mike, were there any particular groups on the East that might have influenced the sound that was coming out of rap a lot at the time?
Probably Public Enemy was a big influence. The Shockley Brothers, their production. I was way into that shit back then. And Dr. Dre and me, we kind of went back and forth stealing ideas from each other. Like, I would do something on record, and I was, oh, he did that. And I'd go, okay, I'm going to take this. And, you know, it's very good, you know, friendly competition.
Definitely the Bomb Squad from Public Enemy just kind of, the way they, you know, threw everything together, and it just had this massive sound, and I think Chuck's just sounded larger than life, and it, I think the content that he was rapping about also matched with the music of just sounding like confusion and stress and angst, and it was just what New York City felt like, was just very influential. Pretty much everything Marley Marl did was just like, you just sat by the radio and just dreamed, like, what on earth, like, how did all this come together? And everything Marley did sounded big and heavy and just strong, and just the bass was just right, the drums, the snare, everything was just, I don't know. I don't know how to explain it just other than to play it, and if you connect with it, you know what I'm talking about. But, you know, definitely Marley, Bomb Squad. Dr. Dre, definitely, when he stepped up, we couldn't stop playing Straight out of Compton. It's just definitely Dr. Dre.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
My name is Jay Period.
Jay Period!
So mine is actually less of a question, but when I interview artists for the mixtapes, one of my favorite things is just to get each artist's kind of frozen, indelible impression of an individual moment from that time that really paints a picture and still sticks with you to this day.
I do. I remember when Pos first played me Break of Dawn. I was kind of speechless because I was like, I'd have never thought to sample Smokey Robinson's, what song was it?
Quiet Storm.
Quiet Storm. And if you're a New Yorker, you know that because WBLS, when the Quiet Storm came on, I mean, it was just like a, like, you're gonna decide if you're gonna be a part of that or if this is time for your, it's time to check out. Maybe this is time for moms to just take over the radio. So when I heard that, I just was stuck because it was just like, how do I react to this? But from being programmed by it just being like the, you know, Quiet Storm Hour on WBLS, which I'm pretty sure a lot of great babies were made off of that. But but just, it was just so rugged too, because it was such a smooth song, and then the drums on top of it. And I was like, man, these guys did it again. You know, that song stands out to me.
How are you? My name is Renee. You know, in 1993, I was about 3 years old. Yeah, I'm really young. But I mean, just listening to everything, like hip hop then and now is totally different. So, you know, I just want to know, do you guys think that you'd be able to adapt to it now, you know, compared to that back then in 93?
I think that, you know, I have to embrace what's going on in 2013. I still have a show, Video Music Box comes on. I'm going to play Drake's new record, or his new video. I'm going to play, you know, 2 Chainz and Pharrell, Fed's watching. You know, I'm going to play, you know, songs like that. And then in the middle of it, you know, I'm going to play, you know, Craig Mack, Get Down. So, you know, if you're 21, you never heard of Craig Mack before, you might watch it because you just watched the Drake video. And so I feel like as a programmer, I'm kind of like bridging the gap. That's my job. As a DJ, I think we do that. You know, I come from the DJ world first in clubs to kind of bridge the gap. You know, most people go, well, the young people that I talk to now, it was like, Biggie is their old school. That's old school, you know? And I'm like, Biggie? Like, you know? And I'm like, okay, so that means there's a lot of work to be done and there's a lot of great music that young people don't know about. And at the same time, the old school heads from back in the days goes, I hate that new music. I hate it. Space music, I hate it. And I'm like, yo, right. And I go like, yo, dog, but you used to be 19, and I'm sure that somebody looked at what you were doing when you were 19 and 20 as space music. So you can't dog out young people's music. You got to listen to it, and you got to be open to it. You know, you don't have to love it. I don't love everything I hear, you know, but there are some things that pop out. You know, like when I first heard A$AP Rocky, I'm like, who's this? He's kind of dope, you know. I got Kendrick. I got it. You know, I see where he's coming from. You know, it's great to have a co-sign by Dre. I got it, you know. And there's a bunch of other artists that are out here, Joey Badass and all these other cats. They feel like the 90s to me right now. So I'm like, is this for real or are they just acting it out?
That's what they listen to. That's what they like.
We got one more.
This is it? The last one?
The last guy.
Yes. What's up, y'all? This is Combat Jack, the Combat Jack Show. Thank you. Great panel. I definitely need to see more of these, but this question is more directed primarily to Prince Paul. In 1994, you dropped the seminal Gravediggers album, 6 Feet Deep, collaboration with you and RZA.
Right.
I thought it was a masterpiece.
Wow, thanks.
It was a slept-on masterpiece, and I was bumping that cassette every day, several times a day, until Biggie dropped. Reasonable. So Biggie changed the game. But
I'm surprised I got that much run, to be honest.
You got that much run. But for such a phenomenal album, you went into the studio in 1993 with RZA, two hip-hop super producers. Can you tell us about that process and how that concept came up? Because my mind is still blown when I think about that album.
Well, thank you. Well, you gotta understand, me and RZA, we have a long relationship. Like, I've known him since the 80s, when Mel Kwan was his manager. And we worked on demos together. There's records we made together that probably the world will never hear. So we've had a long-standing relationship, and my thing towards RZA back then was, I'm gonna show you how to work a lot of this stuff. I mean, I was in the studio when he made Ooh, We Love You, Rakim. I was there for that. You know, I was showing him how to program the SB-12, and it turns out the drum program I programmed turned out to be on that record, but that's another story. So we had a thing where, for me, it was me teaching him things. You know what I'm saying? And in the process, what was brilliant, where I got so, well, I felt technologically advanced, he was just behind that. So I was learning from him, like, wow, you know, if you listen to a lot of Wu-Tang stuff, it's random snares and manual and it's all off. I'm like, that's technologically, that's not right, but yo, it sounds good. So it made me kind of like rethink a lot of my production as well. So we kind of just fed off each other. We inspired each other. But the one thing I really appreciate about working with him is that he gave me the last word, which was nice. We just had a mutual respect. I respected what he did. And then once Wu-Tang came out, I'm like, man, whatever you want to do. It's like, you know, apparently you're doing something right, man. You know, I know when to give it up.
Nah, I definitely suggest. I mean, everybody in here should. If you haven't listened to that album, you definitely got to copy that.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. I didn't think anybody really cared. I mean, you got to understand when that record...
You got to understand. That album was sick.
Listen what I tell you. When that record came out, you know how much flag I got? It was like, oh, man, it's a gimmick. It's this, it's that. And it's not until like 20 years later when a smart gentleman like yourself come up and go, yo, that record was this. I'm like, I appreciate it.
What it was, you know, you had that title, that box, horrorcore, and you guys got shoved into that.
You know who made that up?
It wasn't horrorcore.
You know who made that up? Havelock Nelson. And I'll tell you what happened. I remember he came inside G Street. He's like, how would you guys describe this music? And we was like, I don't know. You know, it's just some dark hip hop. He's like, I'm gonna call it horrorcore. And I was like, please don't do that. And the next thing you know, it became that.
It fucked y'all up, for real, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, and even like coming after the Ghetto Boys, you know, we got like criticized, oh man, the Ghetto Boys did blah, blah, blah. And I was cool with that. I played it to them. You know what I'm saying? I was like, I'm a huge Ghetto Boy fan. So, we got into a lot of flack. It says not until like 20 years later. It's like, yeah, it was a great record.
That's a masterpiece, man.
Sound scan that joint. Yeah. You know?
Absolutely.
Would you say earlier you can't sound scan love?
Sound scan love, yeah, I guess you can't.
I think we can. I mean, we're all here now, right? Yeah, 20 years later.
Thank you for the loving sound scan.
It's called YouTube.
Yeah. Guys, I think we got to call it. But this has been so much fun. Thank you so much to everybody on the panel. Thank you for coming out.